Hello, everybody out in internet land. This is Topical Fever, episode 11. My name is David Parsons, and I thank you very much for tuning in to the podcast and continuing to listen and joining in on the conversation on Twitter and Facebook. This week, we're talking about May Day, a special May Day edition of the show. When I was a kid, I didn't know what May Day was beyond something that Snoopy said when he was dressed up as the Red Baron. But it turns out May Day is a very strange holiday, or a holiday with a strange history. That is, May Day is meant to commemorate events that took place in the United States and had a big impact on American labor history in 1886. And yet the holiday is not really celebrated in the United States. It's more celebrated around the world, known as International Workers' Day. Our Labor Day is something that takes place at the end of summer, and is kind of divorced from its original meaning as something for the working class to kind of come together and commemorate their history and their work. And so that's what I wanted to do today with the show, was talk about labor and check in on what is happening in the labor movement. Because in the United States, it has a curious history, and I don't want to go into the last 50 years of labor history here. But for those of you that don't know, there used to be a pretty robust labor movement, or labor unions had a lot more strength in the United States in past decades. And since the 1950s, I would say there's been a precipitous decline in the power of labor. A lot of that has to do with the fact that labor unions were located in the manufacturing industries that left this country over the last 50 or 60 years. Those manufacturing jobs that were great union jobs have been replaced by service industry jobs, servicing all sorts of consumer industries, everything from being a cashier at Best Buy or Walmart to working in fast food or in the food industry. And the food industry is actually where I wanted to focus on today because of the guests that I have. The two guests that were nice enough to come to over to the apartment and have a nice dinner and have drinks with us and have a nice conversation are Rachel Lears and Robin Blotnick. Rachel and Robin are filmmakers who are currently finishing a film called The Hand That Feeds. The Hand That Feeds, you can read more about at thehandthatfeedsfilm.com. But the film is a documentary that covers a really important moment in the history of labor, in the history of New York City labor, of immigrant labor, and low-wage worker justice. The film is about a group of workers at a small but very profitable chain of New York restaurants called Hot and Crusty. These workers in the past year and a half have waged a really courageous and important battle to gain some respect, some measure of victory against an organization that was exploiting them in a lot of different ways. So this film is a really, really important film, and part of Robin and Rachel's work as filmmakers to kind of expose and bring about social change in areas of worker justice, of labor, and all sorts of other important issues that are going on in politics and in the continued economic crash that we experience. So Robin and Rachel are political filmmakers who talk about their experience with Occupy Wall Street. They talk about their development as documentary filmmakers, and they talk about their experience making this extraordinary film that again covers a really important moment in which workers in the food service industry, which is an industry that has a tremendous amount of exploitation involved in it, are beginning to organize and beginning to win small victories. And I think as people that are concerned about capitalism, that seek some sort of revolutionary moment, I know that my co-host Justin, my frequent co-host Justin, would agree that these victories, these little victories along the way, and they're not little for the people that are involved in them, but these victories along the way are really, really important. It's like the revolution can take place through a series of these victories. And so the Hot and Crusty workers can serve as a really potent example of how people that would seemingly have no power, people that are recent immigrants who are at the bottom of the American class system, actually got together and were able to organize themselves and win some dignity and some respect for what they do, which is help create tremendous wealth for the people at the top of the organizations that are exploiting them. So we had a great conversation with Rachel and Robin. And I have plenty of links up on the blog about their film and about the different work they do. And I hope you enjoy this conversation and that you begin to think about on this May Day the different ways that labor and people and the working class, people that are at the bottom of the food chain, are really making your life possible. The people that are making your food, the people that are serving your food, are people that are just trying to make it like anybody else. And these food service jobs that used to be jobs that we thought of as, you know, teenagers making a few bucks outside of college are now jobs that are the backbone of a working class economy. And that's a really, really dangerous thing when you have jobs that don't pay a living wage, that people are trying to feed families on, and they're working at McDonald's, they're working at Burger King, they're working at these places that are often the only option for many types of people, and they're not able to survive on them. And Robin and Rachel with their film are trying to expose a little bit of that and help contribute to and create a conversation around changing the way we think of food, the way we think of labor, and the way that we think of the people that work in these places. So I hope you enjoy this May Day conversation and join us again on Topical Fever. What amazed me about Occupy is I'm someone who studies the 60s and early 70s, anti-war and social movements, and it's really interesting to see, like, there was such a evolution during that period where it went from a very kind of straightforward, nonviolent civil disobedience of Martin Luther King in the early 50s or late 50s and early 60s, and that stuff ultimately gained such momentum that it went through enormous transformations through radicalism and violence and everything else. And I feel like Occupy Wall Street went through that in like a very brief, like everything. It was like it took all of the 60s and all of that kind of energy and all those transformations, and it was like, it's like it was very much a representation of, this is like a post 60s movement. We're aware of all those, like, we're aware of all those transformations, and we're trying to, it almost made it it's almost what made it more difficult, in a sense, was this kind of like awareness of how many mistakes have been made before.
And a hyper awareness of, I think, the possibility of quote unquote failure. I mean, and I think too, in terms of the dialogue within the left, there was and has been and continues to be so much just, in my opinion, very glib dismissal of Occupy as a failure for not achieving this, that, or the other thing.
Right.
When in fact, you know, the major accomplishment I think happened within the first couple of weeks, which was to change the national conversation about economic inequality.
Yeah, and I mean, and enter things into the lexicon like the 1% and the 99% that actually begin to start conversations, wherever those conversations are. At least we're talking about class, because America is such a weird fucking place when it comes to class, right?
Seriously.
It's like one of the most divisive class societies on earth, and yet class is not something that we talk about because of the kind of overarching mythology of the United States, which is like, we don't have class here. Mm-hmm. Everybody is able to move through the society fluidly, which is, I think you guys understand that that's an insane proposition. But in terms of the filmmaking thing, how did you get involved in filmmaking? Like, how did you get involved in media stuff? I think this is probably a separate story for each of you, but you've kind of come together now into this kind of crew. So I mean, maybe I'll start with Robin. Robin, how did you get into film? Because it sounds like you went to Hunter College for that
a little bit,
right?
Yeah. I've been
in CUNY on this show. Sorry.
Seriously, CUNY. Without CUNY, where would we be?
Right? Yeah, yeah.
I've been into film since I was a little kid. I used to like sort of write scripts for animated Disney movies when I was like 9, and I got a video camera sometime around maybe age 11, and I began working on sort of claymation features, epic claymation features and that kind of thing.
Did you really make claymation?
Absolutely, yeah.
Like with actual clay?
Yeah.
Was this during like the California plasticine raisins period when claymation was like really hot?
Exactly. In fact, I had I used California raisins dolls that I'd won at a carnival. Yeah, yeah.
And I animated them because they were like kind of twisty. So they weren't actually clay, those dolls.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
they
no,
worked.
I know. Yeah. I had a whole collection of those dolls. Yeah. I had the one with the saxophone and everything. Yeah. It's a totally other conversation, but one day we're going to do a Topical Fever podcast about the California Raisins as minstrelsy because there's something.
Oh, oh man. You're
something,
right.
You know what?
They did only sing Motown songs.
Yeah, right. And
what was up
like
with that?
These
yeah.
Weird, yeah, it's yeah. A weird kind of engagement with race there.
That's,
so, okay. You're
never thought of that.
You're making claymation stuff when you're a kid.
Right, and so it was just a natural leap to social justice documentary from there.
From there, you're like the Trotskyist or Marxist Dawson from Dawson's Creek.
Oh man, I used to be compared to him.
I think anyone that was into film during the 90s,
exactly.
Was,
yeah.
Oh, Dawson's Creek. Like, I don't like Steven Spielberg.
Yeah, exactly. I actually used to love Steven Spielberg as a kid, but anyway, yeah, we all did. But I after experimenting a little bit in high school, I actually had the opportunity to take a class in film in my high school, which was really cool. And I watched Michael Moore and I learned a little about documentaries. Uh-huh. And
was it Michael Moore that was part of your politicization?
In a way. I mean, I was always kind of political. My parents actually met at a nuclear power plant protest.
Wow.
So there was always a certain element of...
was this in the
70s?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, totally. Yeah, my parents were kind of the tail end of the baby boomer generation.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And, I was always pretty political. I think probably became really political when I started listening to Clash at 15.
Uh-huh.
You know,
uh-huh.
Like it was sort of a typical high school conversion experience.
Right.
But I... But I
something amazing about that. I mean, culture always gets as a historian. Culture gets shit on all the time as any kind of political mover. But when you talk to people, they're like, "Oh, I heard a Clash song, and that was what was it for
exactly.
me."
Exactly. People
that
say like
amazing.
Protest songs are pointless because everyone already believes what they. That's not true.
No.
I was actually flirting with like Ayn Rand.
Yeah,
and
oh,
I listened
me too.
To the Clash,
yeah.
And then boom, that was it. I was like, I don't like the rich.
Yeah, yeah, no, I mean, I was flirting with Bob Dole in the 90s when
that's disgusting.
Yeah, I know, it's gross. I had an economics high school teacher that showed me Roger and Me, Michael mm-hmm. Moore movie, and I never thought about economics that way. I like literally had never thought of corporations as this kind of thing, and it was mind-blowing. It really was. I think I'm still sitting in that, even though I like here I am 20 years later just being like Michael Moore is a piece of shit provocateur or whatever, but I still like I can be critical of it, but at the same time it was really formative stuff.
Sure.
Seriously.
Okay, so you got it. So then you went to college for film.
Yeah, saw Roger Moore, I mean Michael Moore, attack Roger Moore, and then I went to Hunter College and learned documentary there.
Mm-hmm.
Realized that as much as I love to do fiction film, documentary is a little more accessible,
mm-hmm.
Especially when you don't have a lot of money. And
yeah.
If you don't want to go out to Hollywood and try to climb the ladder, it promises a kind of a jump start where you can just start working.
Yeah.
So
no, on another show, I'll talk about me trying to climb that ladder when I was living in LA and working at NBC when I was young and thinking, and it took, and 9/11 happened while I was working at NBC. And I was like, what the fuck am I doing here? Cause I was working on a really terrible sitcom. Like, I mean, just really bottom of the barrel stuff. I mean, not really bottom of the barrel cause they had millions of dollars and they were making this sitcom, but it made me realize that I like, there's even imagining being at the top of this ladder. I don't want to be on this ladder. The
or
ladder
the top
itself.
Of this barrel.
Yeah, or this barrel. Yeah, these barrels and these ladders are dirty, and I don't want anything to do with them.
They
okay,
are.
So
yeah. So
Rachel, you, how did you get involved in film? Because I know that you went to school for anthropology. You didn't. Your approach was not to go to school for film. So
well, it's actually even more complicated than that. I went to college for music.
Uh-huh.
And I ended up going to graduate school at NYU for ethnomusicology.
Mm-hmm.
And quickly decided that the anthropology department where I was taking classes was more appealing than the music department at that time over 10 years ago for many reasons. you know, professors leaving, various things. And the anthropology department at NYU had a program that involved filmmaking called the Culture and Media Program, which was an additional certificate in history, theory, and production of documentary. So that sounded like an amazing opportunity to me. And I ended up being able to transfer from the music department to the anthropology department and complete that program.
Did you have a built-in interest already in documentary, or was there something that you had brought that you were like, when you heard it, you're like, oh, this is perfect for
Yeah,
me.
It was really more the latter. I mean, I had been my things had been photography and music for a really long time. But when I was in college, digital video didn't exist. You know, I wasn't a kid like Robin who got a video camera when I was little.
Dawson's Creek.
I was not. No. You know, I was in my room composing songs and painting.
But you had a performative thing going on. You had like a kind of media.
Well, I was interested in the arts, and I was interested in culture, and I was interested in politics, and all of these things. And when I look back now at my journals from high school, I think it should have been obvious to me that I would be doing what I'm doing now. But for some reason, it took
a really long
time to.
You almost like nail it down. It's almost like you resist. You become yourself for a long time. I was made to be a history teacher, and I knew that in high school, and I was like, no, I'm Quentin Tarantino. Like, that's what I am. I want to be Quentin Tarantino. Yeah. Then I was like, wait, that's really much harder to accomplish than I thought. I'm a history teacher, actually. Yeah. Like, that's what I am.
Well, I tried to be a classical flutist, and then I tried to be a jazz flutist, and then I tried to be an ethnomusicologist. And when I found documentary filmmaking through this program, it was pretty much like love at first sight.
Yeah,
like, this is going to allow me to do everything I ever wanted to do artistically and intellectually and engage with the world in all kinds of ways. I kind of decided right there that that's what I wanted to do. I had never been really sure about academia.
Yeah.
And so for many years I went back and forth.
Believe me, I'm not sure about it.
Right. Well, I went back and forth about whether to finish my PhD. I ended up finishing it. And I kind of never imagined I'd be this far away from it right now.
It becomes like a grudge to finish it after. That's, at least that's how it felt for
me. It's like, I've been here for 8 years. You know what? Yeah. I'm just going to fucking do it. Yeah. And so... at the time, I think I convinced myself that it would be better for my filmmaking career to finish it than to come that far and not finish it, which may yet prove to be the case. At the moment, you know, aside from our independent projects, you know, we both do freelance work. And so for me, I was doing a little bit of freelancing along the way in graduate school to make ends meet. And to do that full time now, you know, there's certainly moments where I wish I'd thrown myself into it full time a little bit sooner. But, you know, I'm glad I finished. And I think the anthropological worldview is something that informs everything that I do. And
when
think.
You say like you wish like a toe in academia, is that like economic? Like I would have a job? Because if that's true, then I can tell you that it wouldn't be that.
That's actually
the job market, as you know.
No, that is not the reason.
Okay.
No, and it's funny because you know, I went to this conference today at the New School on food and immigrant life, and these conversations happen every so often. Just, you know, when I wind up talking to academics, and also, you know, I went to a cocktail party for a colleague who had a book come out last week, and it's just everybody says the same thing, which is like, you did the right thing.
Yeah.
You are fine. Just do something else.
Academic and the left, and there's a lot of overlap there. There's a lot of self-hatred.
That's not so much what I mean. I mean, it's a hard market. And I think also, you know, there's a somewhat cynical, people are glad that others, that some people kind of drop out of the rat race. Less. But in any case, I'm glad to be doing what I'm doing. And
so here you are, and you're Occupy Wall Street starting to like engage in a political filmmaking, and it seems like that. And I was speaking with you earlier, and you identify as filmmakers primarily, but you have a definite political focus. I mean, it seems like you're making films that are about American society, specifically economic issues around American society. Can you imagine going other places? What is your like kind of general attitude?
Well, I think I can imagine. We've made films about a lot of different things. Each of us separately and together. Uh-huh. And this is the first film that I've made focused in the United States. Mm-hmm. And
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
What are your other things?
My first project was followed two young Uruguayan songwriters uh-huh. through a couple years of their everyday lives, kind of following their creative process and everyday struggles.
And now I'm seeing this synergy between you being the music.
Yes.
And,
yeah. So that uh-huh. was the yeah. that was the crossover point.
Uh-huh.
And I actually made films that definitely connect to what we're doing now, but the first serious attempt I made at a documentary was this film called Chocolate Country, which is about a Dominican cacao cooperative mm-hmm. that it's basically struggling to certify their product fair trade and take advantage of that you know added income. And it's a film about food and labor, which is mm-hmm. what our current project's about. Mm-hmm. At the time, I was kind of pulled into it because my parents were volunteers in the Peace Corps, and they wanted me to come out and film what they were doing. And it just sort of evolved into this 30-minute
documentary. I didn't realize that your parents were activist parents.
Yeah, I mean, activists is... They're sometimes they're activists, and sometimes they're other uh-huh, things. Uh-huh. My dad's also a businessman. But at the time, my parents were volunteers in the Peace Corps, and they were... My dad was teaching a group of cacao farmers how to market themselves to an American fair
Isn't
trade
that interesting?
Organic market.
It's kind of like a proto-capitalist or pseudo-capitalist kind of activism. Yeah,
there's this quality, like in the film Chocolate Country, you see it. There's this weird blurring of the kind of union agitation mm-hmm. with entrepreneurial spirit.
Yeah, right? Yeah, yeah.
And the film... It hit all the right buttons for what it was, and it actually made a bit of a splash. It got an award at the Seattle International Film Festival, and it became this teaching tool for a lot of fair trade advocates,
awesome.
Which was cool. But it also like it had to do with the. I would say that. Man, it's hard to talk about this. I think it's a great film, and I'm really proud of it. But I also see how. The message it portrays is easy to digest for American consumers because it's about a bunch of people who are happily working to create a product for Americans.
And it's got an entrepreneurial edge to it.
And there's a bit of an entrepreneurial edge and there's just, there's not a lot of like difficult questions being.
God, that entrepreneur thing really is such a weird kind of illusion because one of the clips that I remember from Occupy Wall Street that I don't know if you saw this, but it was the most ridiculous thing. It was like a lot of celebrities went down Occupy Wall Street to like visit, and like some of them were cool, some of them were not. Like Alec Baldwin came down there, right? And like there's this amazing clip of him, and he's like, you know, they're surrounded by reporters and cameras and people, and they're like, "What does the guy from 30 Rock have to say about Occupy Wall Street?" Right? And so they ask him. Someone asked him, like, "Are you an anti-capitalist?" And I'm like, "Wow, that's the question I want to hear." You know, yeah. like, is the guy from NBC an anti-capitalist?
He plays the Uber capitalist on 30 Rock.
Right, and he's really great at playing this kind of parody of this right-wing guy. So he goes, and you know, as Alec Baldwin is known kind of liberal dude. You know, he's almost often parodied. But they ask him, "Are you an anti-capitalist?" And his answer kind of stunned me because he was like, "Oh no, oh God, no." He was like, "I don't think anyone here is an anti-capitalist." And he said that. He said that. I swear to God, where there's like fucking people behind him that have signs that are literally anti-capitalist signs, like literally like Socialist Alliance signs, and signs that are clearly.
That's hilarious.
And what he, but what he.
That's
follow,
an amazing moment.
I know, but what he follows up with is he goes, he says like, "I don't think anyone here is anti-capitalist. I think that, I don't think anyone would want to stop like the next Steve Jobs." From like coming up with something cool in his garage and then becoming a millionaire. I think that's really the American dream. And it was like, wait a second, that's not the reality though. Like that, I mean, that doesn't describe how capitalism works at all. Like that idea of like the scrappy young, you know, guy or girl coming up with a cool product and becoming a millionaire off of it is a fantasy. It's not really how capitalism and the structure of capitalism works at all. Anyway, I just thought it was like a perfect example of how Occupy Wall Street attracted this kind of sometimes like people that just said the things that they didn't get what it was about. Yeah. And like, that's the thing that's so weird to me about Occupy Wall Street, this narrative that was put on it by the mainstream media that was kind of like, well, there are a whole bunch of confused people that don't really have a program, when it was like very clear what Occupy Wall Street was about. Like, if you were serious at all, like if you had any thought in your mind at all, it was very easy to decipher what Occupy Wall Street was about.
Really not
It was about the corruption of the political and financial system in the United States.
But I think by being against the banks, there's always been an American tradition of bashing the banks on both the populist right and the populist left. And I think like by sort of having an anti-banker message and also not really stating clearly what their demands were, I think they allowed people to kind of project all sorts of things onto them. Yeah, and it was generally positive. People are generally like, I mean, it was kind of like during the anti-globalization protests of the late 90s. Mm-hmm. Like
the battle in Seattle.
You see these Darth Vader stormtroopers against these kids, and people generally are just like, oh, I don't know what the politics are, but I support those kids versus those like,
robot cops. Except that didn't take off in the...
It didn't have that viral spark
It didn't tap into a nerve of discontent.
Right, right.
That, you know, coming on the heels of a massive economic crisis in the same way.
Yeah.
So,
Do you guys see a movie, by the way, called When a Tree Falls?
Yeah.
Documentary? Yeah. I just watched that the other day, and like that guy Daniel McGowan got arrested again.
He did, I heard about that.
Yeah, and he got arrested for blogging about his experience.
Right, which for some reason he was prohibited from doing.
Yeah, yeah. So I want to talk about the film that you're working on now. Because when I think about food, and I'm a big food politics person in the sense that I think that the way we eat, the way we grow our food, and the way we... consume and the way food is produced is a big lens on politics, a big place where you can locate a lot of what's wrong politically. Mm-hmm. And obviously I'm not the only person that thinks this. In fact, it's become a kind of trend in a weird way. And like, you know, from everything from the Park Slope Food Co-op to, you know, giant corporations like Whole Foods are all kind of playing off this idea that people want to have a purer experience of food. And a lot of that is, you know, I think of like Jonathan Safran Foer wrote this book, Eating Animals, that was like very much kind of drove this kind of like a conversation about veganism and the way animals are treated, factory farms, very important stuff. But a lot of it is framed around kind of the animals and how the animals are treated. And I thought I wanted to talk to you guys, because you guys are working on a site that I think is kind of being ignored in food politics, not ignored, but maybe put on the back burner in a sense, that human beings are producing food and that the labor aspect of food production and food consumption is highly problematic and a site where we can actually, as people that are concerned about eating and concerned about the, you know, eating, having the pure political experience of food, need to turn an eye on labor. So I feel like you guys are making a film about that. Can you describe like, what is your film about? Yeah.
Well, our film follows the story of a group of undocumented immigrants at a bakery cafe on the Upper East Side of New York who go up against a massive, it's a big chain owned by powerful investors.
Hot and crusty. Is it hot and crusty crusty?
I believe it's and.
I think it's an and.
Hot and crusty.
Hot and crusty. And
there's a few of them in New York. Is that right?
There are.
Because I've seen them around.
Yeah.
And they're kind of a New York icon.
Right.
Uh-huh.
And so it's a New York chain owned by powerful private equity investors. Uh-huh. And the workers win. They go through a lockout. They end up winning a lawsuit for back wages and overtime. They hold an occupation with Occupy Wall Street activists occupying the store before it's closed
down. So this was taking place in 2012?
Yep.
And this is unprecedented in a sense. Is that right? Like, I mean, there's something that you haven't seen low-wage workers have a success like this before.
Right.
At least not since, the UFW and Cesar Chavez. And
that kind of thing.
This is like a pretty exciting new
trend. It's interesting. Like in certain ways, it's connected to a wave of low wage worker organizing in the service sector that was happening in 2012 and 20 beginning around the time of Occupy as well.
And it seems like it's still continuing.
It is continuing.
Yeah,
it's totally continuing.
Exciting about it.
And in other ways, it's there are certain things about this particular story that make it unique. So there are other. There are a number of car washes in New York City that unionized in 2012. There are there's a supermarket, the Golden Farm in Kensington, Brooklyn.
So it's not just food. It's like a service industry kind of thing
going
on right
now. That's the movement is looking at low wage jobs in the service sectors, which includes food.
Walmart has,
of course, retail.
So you know now, I feel stupid as an American historian because I'm now making the connection, which is that the larger connection, obviously, is that the United States used to be a manufacturing
economy, and
that's
now it's
where the working
economy.
Class and the unions were. They decided that the unions had fucked with their profits too much. Yep. They outsourced that stuff. The United States converted to a service economy, and that's what most of the working class is doing.
That is exactly where we're at right now.
You can actually see very clearly in the 2008 crisis how a larger percentage, the bulk of the jobs that were lost in that crisis were mid-wage, middle-class jobs.
Mm-hmm.
The bulk being regained now in the recovery are low-wage service sector jobs. Mm-hmm. So we're just seeing that trend continues.
And the way the federal government talks about jobs is just that, right? Jobs.
Right,
like
jobs.
It's not like what kind of job.
Yeah,
exactly.
There's no discussion.
And a job is not a job. I'm sorry, but a job is not a job. They are very different in terms of what kinds of jobs you can
have. And so employers or businesses will often take this line as well of, you know, in order to create, we don't want to have requirements for the labor conditions on, you know, raising the minimum wage, or guaranteeing certain benefits, all of these things would inhibit us from creating a greater number of jobs. And what that really means is, you know, we would create a greater number of jobs, but they would be worse jobs.
Right, right.
And you might not be able to eat if you work at a job.
And of course, so huge numbers.
Like you're talking about jobs that don't provide a living wage, essentially.
Exactly. So what ends up happening, huge numbers of people in these low-wage service sector jobs are relying upon food stamps, Medicaid, sometimes even public assistance. So in that sense, the government is literally underwriting the business models of
and pushing people
these
onto
major corporations.
Onto these, Medicare, disability programs, and then we have a discourse about people on welfare, which is unbelievably unfair.
Right.
How did you get involved in doing a film about Hot and Crusty? Like, where did that come from?
Well, it came from the Immigrant Worker Justice Working Group at Occupy Wall Street, which after, you know, around in the first couple months of 2012, the media group, along with many working groups at that point, it was a couple months after the eviction of Zuccotti Park, and the structure of Occupy Wall Street was deteriorating. We were talking about this a little bit a few minutes ago, but, you know, I think it can't be, no narrative of the rise and fall or whatever you want to call it of Occupy Wall Street. You can't tell that story without acknowledging both the external repression and the fact that there was a coordinated effort between the federal national security apparatus and major city police departments to basically make it clear that there would be no more occupation of public space.
Yeah.
You have to acknowledge that, and you also have to acknowledge that there were a lot of internal problems with what was going on, and that's a much broader can of worms.
Oh yeah, and it's a conversation that we're actually going to keep having. But what's really interesting to me is like and enraging about what you just said about like you know the how bad the repression was with Occupy Wall Street was when you compare it to its corollary, and I hate this, the Tea Party is like the Tea Party is like the right wing Occupy Wall Street, which I think is a really problematic dichotomy.
Sure.
But either way, the Tea Party was not met with repression this way. And what for me it was like another one of those instances where it's like, come on, Americans, like put two and two together here. Like, look how the state reacts to Occupy Wall Street compared to the Tea Party.
Right,
and you can understand a little bit of like what the state's interests really are and like who they're with. And I mean, the Occupy Wall Street thing, we all, And I think you guys know as much as anyone else that it was horrifying watching that happen and watching the police be unleashed in that way.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. So I was just going to say, though, that so the media group kind of dissolved partly under the weight of its own discussions of process at that time. It was the same thing happened
and
to
also,
a number of
this
groups.
Is the, this also is continuing the, on the microcosm of the 60s left in a sense.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Like, we got so contentious that we fell apart.
And when the nationwide media kind of stopped covering Occupy Wall Street, I think a lot of the fire kind of went out of the citizen journalism that spread around that, because no one was paying as much attention.
And yet here I am. You know, we're sitting here talking, and we're talking on the night that I haven't checked my social media or news for a while now. I don't know what's going on in Boston, but I've been watching. We've been watching the kind of unfolding of the Boston police state thing happening with the Boston Marathon bombing, and. You know, I have to say that my Twitter has been filled with, you know, I still follow Occupy Wall Street. I still follow anonymous who aren't exactly Occupy Wall Street or a kind of separate thing, but are associated.
Certainly a lot of overlap. Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of overlap. And, you know, those Twitter accounts, whoever they are still producing like a tremendous amount of like information and engagement with these politics. Occupy Wall Street, I think, may be a distant memory for, you know, Ma and Pa America that only get their info from Fox News and MSNBC. But for those of us that are engaged in a kind of what I consider the real conversations that we're allowed to have on social media and with the kind of technology we have now, know that Occupy Wall Street was, for me, I feel like it's dormant. At this point, it's kind of like it's still there. The energy, I mean, all of that energy, it's not like the economy got better. It's not like the problems that Occupy Wall Street pointed out and that resonated with so many people around the world went away. It's just that I feel like we're back in the huddle for a minute. You know,
as our friend Donald in Immigrant Worker Justice said, it's like a river and we're just kind of floating along right now. And we'll get back to the rapids soon.
Yeah, yeah. 2011 was the rapids. Yeah.
Right. And I love, as anyone listening to this show knows, I love river metaphors. So a lot of that comes
There's
up.
One for
you should bring Donald on. He's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We should point out that many of our colleagues in the Occupy Wall Street Media Working Group have continued producing stuff and are continuing to produce interesting coverage that no one else has covered.
Absolutely. I trust these Twitter accounts not just like information, but like viewpoints and like I don't know. There's a spirit there. I think that's important. That's more than just the kind of a kind of left political thing. There's a real kind of it's what my friend Justin that's on the show a lot would call like an affective politics, but there's something like there's a feeling there, and I think you used the word intuition, Rachel, when you were discussing with earlier that like that there was a kind of intuitive feeling that like something was going on here that is really striking.
So yeah, we became involved with the Immigrant Worker Justice Working Group, which there came a point in the early spring last year where I was kind of hearing around and about, you know, Immigrant Worker Justice is the place to be in Occupy. You know, there's the only group that's actually getting anything done. Their meetings are really productive and they don't go on for hours and hours and they just, you know,
doesn't get these super theoretical. They're going to actually do something.
They're doing stuff.
And that's appealing.
And so that was really, so we started attending these meetings and we met the folks from the Laundry Workers Center who were organizing at the Hot and Crusty Bakery. And they'd only.
What is the laundry? Because I saw that in an article I was reading about laundry, about the Hot and Crusty thing. And how is the Laundry Workers Center associated with Hot and Crusty?
Well, the Laundry Workers Center is a nonprofit organization that offers resources to workers, particularly immigrant workers and their families who are facing issues of injustice in the workplace. So
it's a very small, very new workers center.
Formed right around the time in fall of 2011, independently from Occupy Wall
Street.
Interesting. Yeah. And so they have trainings. For leadership trainings for workers who want to become involved in their own workplace organizing campaigns. So there's very much a focus on training workers to lead their own struggles.
Right, right.
And they also have legal support. So they helped the Hot and Crusty workers to file a lawsuit for back wages and overtime under the Wage Theft Prevention Act, which is New York state law, just only a couple of years old, which was a huge a huge thing that was able to push the campaign forward. So that they went public with that campaign in January of 2012, and we weren't connected with them yet at that time.
Uh-huh.
Just a couple months later, we met them, and kind of it became immediately clear, all right, these people are going to be doing something interesting. They're already talking about occupying the workplace.
Yeah, yeah.
They're talking about taking forms of direct action that are very unusual in the labor movement and haven't happened in New York in a generation, and really only, you know, Republic Windows and Doors in Chicago is kind of the only precedent in this.
Right. That was and this, that was at the early part of the Obama administration.
Yeah.
I remember.
Yeah.
And that was one of the moments where he was like, I support those workers. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, this Obama guy might be cool.
Yeah, that was
and that was probably the last moment that thought ever crossed my mind.
Right.
So can you talk a little bit about like what it was like to work with these workers? Like what was it like to what kind of people were I mean for those of that are listening now that are like, who are these people? Where are they from? Yeah. What are they like? And can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure.
Yeah. The main sort of star of our movie at this point is Malma Lopez, and he is he's a guy from Mexico City, grew up in kind of a working class family in the suburbs of Mexico City, and he crossed over undocumented. He'll tell you proudly and boldly that he crossed the border illegally.
That he's an illegal.
With coyotes.
I love that word.
Yeah.
It's just illegal.
He's an illegal.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And he actually married a U.S. citizen, and he's still an illegal because we just recently found this out. He's still not able to get a green card because of a law that was passed under Clinton, I believe.
No, Bush. Bush criminalized the act of... Under Clinton, it was... There were possibilities for, you know, regularizing your status. Mm. If you had crossed illegally, you could still get married or get sponsored through a job. Mm-hmm. But Bush changed that law after 9/11 to actually criminalize it, as far as we understand it.
Yeah.
And this, we might want to fact check this before going up.
But he married an American citizen, a Puerto Rican woman from New York, and yet he still can't. He's still not a citizen. He's an incredible guy. There's just something about him. He's an incredibly laid back. He was originally kind of a shy character, but his leadership skills became more and more apparent as he engaged in this process, and he's now. Someone who can just speak before a huge crowd of people in English, which is not a language he's that comfortable in, and just kind of make everyone laugh and put everyone at ease.
Right.
And nonetheless, like, remind everyone of the incredible importance of what he's doing.
And the seriousness of it. And that's what's interesting about the best leaders are the ones that are able to balance that. The ones that are able to, I mean, even Obama, that's what's, I mean, kind of sick about it, is that he's kind of mastered the game of being like the attractive, appealing, authentic personality that then is able to say, you know, we need to have predator drones. And so it's like, that's what's disturbing about that. So
As we can tell, Malma is one of these people who's just like incredibly charismatic and also trustworthy.
But a charismatic force for good. Yeah.
He seems to really be a good guy all the way. So
And so it sounds like you had like a, in terms of solidarity, the Hot and Crusty workers had an extraordinary experience with that.
Absolutely.
This was not easy.
And this was one of the most exciting things about this campaign. Mm-hmm. It's never easy for workers to do this, this type of thing. So not only did they have the legal and organizing resources of the Laundry Workers Center behind them, but they also had the entire immigrant worker justice group of Occupy Wall Street, which involved a lot of people involved in that are organizers or work in various ways with other organizations, be they worker centers or other organizations around the city dealing with
workers
and immigrant rights groups. So, we were able to bring out, before we were involved, they did this at the campaign launch in January of 2012, and then we became part of it as the story moved on. But, bringing out crowds to support the workers at these crucial moments. And that's something that really, it was an interesting process because this is something that was not getting a lot of media attention.
No.
Eventually it began to get some coverage in alternative presses, but it really made clear that, okay, this is at the same time that Occupy Wall Street, all of Occupy Wall Street is bemoaning the fact that the national media is no longer paying attention to us.
Right.
Here is a small group of people who, as Occupy Wall Street, you know, claiming this mantle of Occupy Wall Street, is marching into the private equity firm of the owner of Hot and Crusty and saying, with signs, and saying like, OWS is watching you. Yes. And this guy doesn't know the difference between the spokes council and the GA and the IWJ group of six people and their friends who managed to show up. It's just like, shit, OWS is on my tail and knows where I work.
Yeah, at that point, the name was still very fearsome, I think, to a lot of,
a lot of
people who are working in private equity like these guys. So
I hope it regains that fearsomeness. I really do.
Well, so then in August, you know, so in what happened with the story was that in May, the workers won recognition from the NLRB as an independent union, the Hot and Crusty Workers Association. Mm-hmm. And they had decided to file for recognition, which is a very unusual step. Most worker centers' campaigns don't take that step for a variety of reasons. But in this case, the workers really wanted to because their employers refused to negotiate terms and conditions of employment. They were in the middle of this class action lawsuit for back wages and overtime, but they wanted to talk about benefits. They wanted to talk about sick days. They wanted to talk about all kinds of other issues.
They wanted to talk about the way they were treated.
Exactly.
Because they had some managers who
that's the thing that hasn't come up yet is conditions. We talk a lot about wages and benefits, but conditions too, right? And
I think that meant more to a lot of them.
Really?
Can you
describe why? What were the conditions?
There were a few managers that were employed at that particular branch of Hot and Crusty that treated the workers incredibly abusively. I mean, they would insult them. They would
verbal
swear
abuse,
at them.
Sexual harassment.
There was
women.
Sexual harassment of some of the women. I mean, it was just I think on a lot of levels. Many people would have been content to continue making the wages they were making if their managers weren't treating them like less than human.
Yeah, right. Yeah. That's really interesting. Part of it is that's what kind of fuels it. You know, what's interesting to me that I'm thinking about now is like the fact that I think that a lot of people that I've talked to and a lot of people that I've talked to about how they came to kind of a class awareness is to work in restaurants.
Yeah.
And like, that's kind of amazing is that it wasn't working at a factory or some like kind of traditionally left place, you know, it was actually working in the service industry that made them more aware of class and how it functions and how labor and how different forms of labor are exploited. And particularly that has, you know, racial, ethnic, and obviously class kind of connotations. But, you know, for me, I worked in a lot of corporate restaurants, and you guys tell me that you worked in the food industry too, and you can kind of see that there's a hierarchy there. And I was the guy that was the white dude that gets to work in the front of the house, that gets to serve, wait on tables, make tips, and make pretty good money, honestly. And like, what was interesting is that I'm sitting there watching, and I was out of college, so I'd already been kind of educated, and I'm like, wow, I'd never really seen it in action before. Mm-hmm. Like, class was a theory. It was something that was kind of like, well, obviously there are poor people somewhere. I'm from the suburbs. I don't know where they are. But now I'm in a restaurant in the mall, and there they are. And the poor people are largely brown people, and people that are in California speaking Spanish. And it was jarring. It really was. And I think that had a big part of fueling like my larger thinking about like it was a series of steps. It was like the high school teacher showing me the Michael Moore and then going to work in a restaurant and saying like, holy shit, there really is something to this. There's vulnerable populations are the ones that are doing the shittiest work in America. And that's not an accident.
And this also gets at what you were mentioning earlier about the transition from manufacturing to service economy, which is why the organizing in the low wage service sector is so important now across retail, food service, all of these types of industries, because, you know, if you think about it, if we were able to organize these industries and raise the wages to living wage levels in these industries, we could lift millions of people out of poverty and into the middle class, which would be analogous to what happened with manufacturing in the first half of the 20th century.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you pointed that out because it's something that I bring up in my classes a lot is that, you know, there was a moment in American life, and I think that people like Michael Moore definitely like over romanticize this moment in like capitalism, a love story. He certainly does it. He romanticizes the like the 50s were the greatest time because you could have a manufacturing job and be middle class. But there is some truth to that.
Yeah, there is a lot of truth.
Yeah,
or you could be, my grandfather was an appliance salesman with a family of five.
Yeah, yeah. And he supported five
children,
and,
a family of seven. You know,
it's not possible anymore.
Like, it's unthinkable.
I feel like as a professor and with my wife being a professor, we're middle class people making middle class income, and we're nowhere near buying a house. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
because of
yeah.
student debt.
It's a totally different
economy. Because of, don't even get started about the inflation of real estate prices in New York,
right. and so
which is a whole separate
we're
issue.
We're these people that are like on the surface privileged people in a sense. You know, we made it. We got PhDs. We're professors.
Yeah.
And yet we can't really afford much because we're drowning in debt. And if that's us, then imagine the people that are fucking way worse off than us. I mean, I won't speak for Claudia, but myself, I've rode white privilege in a lot of ways to this position, and I still can't afford a lot. So it's like, what does that say about like that the white privilege guy?
Right.
The people that don't have that are suffering way worse.
Right.
Even Michael Moore would admit, I think, in Capitalism, a Love Story, that particular heyday was only for the white men. Like it was a special moment for white men. But today,
like not even black men were included in it.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah. But today, even white
or
men,
white women.
If they're part of the 99%.
Well, women, not even a consideration. I mean, that's obviously something to talk about, too. So,
but it's still like white women would benefit from that income. And
that's true.
And today, we're living in a situation where it's really...
It's like every household requires a double income, at least. I mean, that feminist issue of women should work or women shouldn't work is almost a moot point at this point. It's like because of the economic considerations, everyone has to work.
Well, it reminds me of this interesting statistic. I think there was an article in Dissent, I believe, a month or two ago, calculating the minimum wage that it would actually take in New York City to live above the poverty line to support a family of three. And that was $32 an hour.
Ugh.
So what that means is that if even, you know, the suggested in Albany, they're discussing raising the minimum wage to $9 an hour. Even if each member of that three-person family worked a full-time minimum wage.
To support a family, support, feed, and shelter a family. And I mean, this was an article that I think came out, the Dissent article you just mentioned reminds me of another study that came out recently. That was basically declaring that there is not a single, at this point in 2013, there is not a single county in the United States where a minimum wage job can afford 40 hours a week can afford a one bedroom apartment. Not a single place.
Wow.
And so it's like, doesn't that give the lie to the whole lie?
Absolutely.
I mean, it really, if we can't even have that, and I mean, there's so many issues with that, but for me, the thing that I'm concerned with a lot is just human dignity, you know, and
absolutely.
The fact that you can't even fucking work at McDonald's and make it. Like, you got to work, you got to live with your parents, and a lot of people don't have parents to live with, so they got to...
Or overcrowding if you're not living with your parents, maybe you're living with way too many roommates for what is...
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, and all sorts of uncomfortable social arrangements come out of that. But what's amazing to me is that we have this kind of food politics moment with like Super Size Me, Food Inc., all these kind of things. Organic.
Yeah.
I think it's really great. I think it's really awesome that we're talking about food and we're talking about how food is produced. And yet, you know, I think like if you talk to Morgan Spurlock, he'd be like, "Don't go to McDonald's because the food is shit."
Right.
And it's like, well, yeah, the food is shit, but what about the person at the cash register?
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? Like, I'm concerned about how the cow was treated, and I'm concerned about the poison I'm being fed. But
there's
maybe we ought to be thinking about the person that's sitting behind the cash register being exploited at every level of their existence.
Right. And when we're worried about people being on welfare, people being on disability, Social Security, and how that's a drain on our, like...
Those
like,
corporations love them being on welfare because they're not going to pay them.
And isn't it really the responsibility of our business community to provide jobs that are better
than government handouts.
Yeah, I agree.
To pull people off of that stuff rather than to just sort of force people off and force them to get jobs that don't actually pay the rent.
So I want to give a shout out to a couple of organizations that are working on this issue.
And I can shout them out on the blog too, so please.
So there are a couple of organizations involved in worker organizing in the food industry that are really focusing on this tactic of making consumers who are concerned about the ethical sourcing of their food to get them to really consider labor as part of that equation. So Rock United Restaurant Opportunity Center, which has a New York branch, and the Food Chain Workers Alliance, which looks at the connection across the industry from farm workers to processing plants to distribution, to retail, to service, right? Those are the five areas of the food industry. And often, you know, there's a lot of talk about in the food justice literature, which is growing, you know, academic as well as activist
popular,
field.
Yeah, it's everywhere.
A lot
of
times, the only if workers are mentioned at all, it's often farm workers.
And
that it'll stop there without considering distribution and service.
Service worker is a more uncomfortable conversation to have. I think most people, and I include myself growing up in Southern California, I used to, my mom would drive me to school in the morning and we'd drive through strawberry fields to go to school. And I used to call them the slaves. There are the slaves. And it was not, it was like kind of a, just a stupid thing to say as a kid, like, oh, there are the slaves. But now I think like, wow, that's actually true. You know, like there's actually like, and I wanted to point out, you know, I want to make sure that we're clear about something that maybe hasn't come up, which is that, you know, the reason that the companies that produce this food in these heinous ways that people are starting to get concerned about, you know, about like their type, the type of chicken they eat or the type of beef they eat or the type of fruit and vegetable they eat, that the companies are using labor like this and vulnerable labor because they want to get away with it. And they know that vulnerable labor, people that are illegal immigrants, people that are at the bottom of the class system in America, are the people that are least likely to say anything about it. And so that's what allows them to get away with all those food practices that we are concerned about. That's like, oh, I don't want that on my plate. So it's like what I see you guys as doing as part of this hot and crusty thing. The film that you're making is kind of an intervention on that, and that's why I think that's really great. It's like this kind of moment to kind of insert a little bit more. You know what I mean? Like, okay, we're going to have this food conversation. Let's have this food conversation.
Yeah.
And it's actually like gets you into much bigger economic issues than the chicken.
It's like if you take a few minutes and meet Mahoma or some of our other characters, Margarito, Diana, you're going to see people who are undeniably like yourself, your family, your friends. And the more you get to know them, the more you realize that there's really very little separating us from them. They're just behind the counter and you're the one ordering the food, you know?
Yeah.
And I think once people start to make that leap, they're gonna become a little more aware of what that means.
I agree. And I feel like there has to be an intervention on the kind of contempt that people have for workers. You know, I feel like there is a kind of contempt.
Well, they're supposed
to be
invisible.
There's this really stupid cultural thing that's about that's about kind of how it's miserable to go into McDonald's because the workers are so dumb.
Well,
and that is a really, really vicious kind of meme.
About service. I mean, so many people's interactions with the service industry is just to be either completely dismissed. A good server is someone you don't even notice, right?
It's almost like they're
at
part
best,
of the
you're invisible.
Overall product.
At worst, I'm going to complain about you because you're a pain in my ass.
Yeah, it's like
being
a film editor.
And when you say, complain about, you know, a lot of that it has a racial edge to it.
Absolutely.
100%.
Absolutely.
And so, the idea of like, you know, the McDonald's worker being as part of the overall poison of McDonald's, I think is really, really important conversation to have because it allows you a gateway to talk about, you know, my big thing, which is this manufacturing service thing. That's what we lost. You know, when it isn't an accident that manufacturing in this country went away. It went away because workers demanded more.
Right.
And I mean, we can go as Marxist as we want with that, but what you're talking about is like labor is the heart of capitalism, and capitalists have no respect for that whatsoever.
And as a result of manufacturing disappearing, So many adults have been forced into service sector jobs that were previously the domain of teenagers, right? So that's a lot of, I think a lot of middle class people still have this kind of prejudice and this idea that these are jobs worked by teenagers. So it doesn't matter if they pay enough to live
on. Right, right.
But if you see today in New York City, it's not the case.
No,
at all.
It's not.
People are supporting families on these incomes and they need to be paying a living wage.
You're explaining one reason why I can't go in those places to buy a Frosty at Wendy's anymore. And I think it was honestly for me. And I'm not making a point here. It's like, I don't eat fast food. I don't watch TV. I'm better than everyone else. I'm not trying to make that point. I just don't eat fast food because I can't anymore. Yeah. I mean, I literally just can't bring myself to do it. And for a long period of time, I was like, well, I'm not hurting anyone except myself because the food sucks. And I've had a few beers and I got to get that Big Mac, you know, it's not about the food anymore, is what
right.
I'm saying.
Right.
It's like the food doesn't
it's
matter.
System.
It's like, I don't want to go give money to this. I don't want to go interact with someone that's for me being punished in a weird way. You know, like this is a person that's being punished. This is a person that's not living a life that's full. And it's the corporation that's doing this to them.
And well, they're making incredible profits.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They
it's not like McDonald's is like, oh, we have to do this so we can turn a dollar. I mean, you're talking about the most powerful financial institutions in the world doing this stuff.
I want to get back for just a second to the issue of health. There is a really strong correlation between restaurants that don't give a damn about their employees and those that are not that concerned with the health of their with health and safety standards for food handling.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
One, the issue where this comes up most obviously is paid sick days.
There's been a big fight with that with
right here in New York
Bloomberg
just recently.
And Quinn. Yes.
Yes. Uh-huh. So this is an ongoing struggle, and you know the huge majorities, I don't have the statistic in front of me, but it's a very, very large percentage of workers
that's
in the
enough,
restaurant
that's
industry.
For the podcast.
It's something between 70 and 90, you know, don't have paid sick days or don't know that they do.
Uh-huh.
And so they feel that, and in fact, they can't take time off when they're sick.
Yeah.
And this is not only an inhumane labor practice, but it also puts customers at risk.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's exploitation at every level and in every area of it. I feel like in a weird way, it's unsustainable. And people like you guys and other people who are engaged in this question and engaged in this discussion are people who are trying to push that discussion to a place where we can realize that, where we can say, this is not going to last. This is not going to be something that can produce any kind of good society. We have to move forward. This isn't about this isn't about just eating good meat. It's about the whole system that produces that meat and that nasty McDonald's burger or hot and crusty.
Hot and crusty mozzarella and sun-dried tomato wrap.
Yeah, is that what they have?
They have a lot of different things.
Yeah, do they do like an organic thing?
No, they don't. But I just want to say
it's kind of like classic New York, like breakfast and lunch food. Like
okay, I think I've been there
pizza.
Years ago. I went there.
Yeah.
It's good.
Yeah.
There's got a lot of good stuff.
Yeah, yeah. We actually enjoy work. You know, attending that place because they're a union shop now, and we like the people who work there, and we.
Is it okay to go to Hot and Crusty?
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah, go.
Particularly
them.
The one on
63rd Street and 2nd
and
Avenue.
And say hello to the workers.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Absolutely.
It's like, yeah, go ahead.
I just wanted to say really quickly about you can't have a conversation about sustainability without talking about labor in the food industry or any other industry.
I think that's a good note to kind of end on and wrap up is that you cannot have a conversation about sustainability as it being the buzzword without talking about labor. I mean, that's really what more than anything else, it's what drives everything else is kind of how people are working, how people are sustaining themselves, and how people are able to sustain themselves. And if those options aren't available for them at all, and then I think the options are getting shittier and shittier. And without an intervention, without striking, without being more active, and however that comes out, you know, I mean, Occupy Wall Street is obviously having a conversation about what forms these kinds of activities are going to be, but either way, there has to be some intervention, because the way it's going is right. producing a society that's creating more and more poverty and people on the bottom. Mm-hmm. And what I like about your movie is that it's an underdog story, you know, yeah. and not only an underdog story from American labor perspective, but these are like the most outcast of the American labor fight.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And so I'm really looking forward to seeing your work.
The other thing I think that's really important to drive home is that not only is it a classic underdog story, but it's a story of taking direct action mm-hmm. in ways that I think the labor movement has been cautious
reluctant.
About
and reluctant for too long. About and thinking that yeah. that's not effective and
exactly
then, and actually like
it's and, the only way
yeah
and it works just, remarkably well in
yes.
this story
and
I can't say it will always work, but it definitely works in this
yeah,
story
yeah and as you know my friend and I were talking today about the Boston situation as the police state and you know however you want to construct that as the kind of forces of repression make it more and more clear that they're willing to take extreme measures to control the population of this country, it's even more important that we organize ourselves and we organize ourselves smartly along you know, for me I've kind of settled on a kind of Martin Luther King Gandhi nonviolent civil disobedience thing. I don't know if that's the right way to go, but either way it's really important that we come together to figure out how to confront this because it's not like it's not a neutral moment. The forces of evil, however you want right. to think of them, the forces of evil are very much at work right now, bringing down the curtain on a lot of this stuff in terms of labor, in yeah. terms of activism and everything else. So it sounds like your movie is hitting on some really, really important stuff.
Absolutely.
I hope so.
The activists in our film are certainly believers in nonviolent tactics, but they do employ some pretty direct stuff.
Like, yeah, yeah.
That, you know,
sometimes the law has to be broken.
Not yet. Nonviolent yeah. doesn't necessarily mean unconfrontational.
Yeah. yeah, I mean, there's covering up of security cameras. Uh-huh, there's yeah. occupation of a store. You know, it's
exciting.
It's very tense. It's very dramatic. And in the mm-hmm. end, it's incredibly successful. And I think that...
In very concrete. Ways.
Yeah, yeah,
we've
yeah.
seen how far the NYPD will go to defend, you know, Goldman Sachs and,
uh-huh.
and Citibank. But like, when it comes to these smaller restaurants, they're not always going to step in that quickly.
Yeah, right.
There's a
lot they
that,
were there. They were there.
They,
in yeah.
they definitely came at the end of the day. But like,
uh-huh.
there's a lot of
for
wiggle room.
Several
That's
hours,
there
the
are,
store
yeah.
was
yeah.
occupied without. Their presence.
There are
exactly.
cracks and fissures,
exactly.
and there are
yeah.
Though these institutions that are oppressing us are vulnerable too,
mm-hmm.
and we can find their
yep.
vulnerabilities and exploit them. And I love that. I love that you guys are doing that.
And the best way to do it. The other thing I think is that an incredibly important lesson from the story is organizing and solidarity across. Class and ethnic lines.
Yeah, yeah. And, that,
absolutely.
You know, and that's what I was trying to get at with like the guy that goes into McDonald's and buys the Big Mac and has contempt for the person, the racial contempt. That's something that has to be worked on. That's a
absolutely.
That's a, and, mm-hmm. and for me, my hobby horse is that's kind of a cultural project. You know, that's something
totally.
That we have to change people's minds. There has to be a kind of cultural / spiritual
yeah.
revolution in cross class empathy. And I'm glad you brought that up too. So maybe that's a good place to leave. It. I just want to thank Robin and Rachel for joining me today. It was a great conversation, and
thanks.
And I wish you guys luck with your film.
Thank you.
Thank
Did
you
we
very
mention
much.
The name of it?
Yeah. What is the name of your film?
The Hand That Feeds.
The Hand That Feeds.
The Hand That Feeds
yeah.
film.com, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Go to thehandthatfeedsfilm.com for more information.
Thank you so much.
And also, we're going to be in the Workers Unite Film Festival May 13th.
Uh-huh.
And 17th.
17th.
With
Friday
a short preview
cool.
from the Working
With a
Progress.
Very, very short preview of what the feature film, which will come out at the beginning of 2014.
That's going to be awesome, and I wish you luck with it. Thank you
Thanks
very
so much.
All right.
Yeah.